This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll take a look at where we stand on Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty 50 years later. But first, Connecticut is getting hit by another winter storm, and this is a messy one. Governor Daniel Malloy is back at the Emergency Operations Center. He briefed the media about a half hour ago.
We expect conditions to deteriorate in the next few hours. We expect this storm to continue to about 6 a.m. Tomorrow morning.
Joining us by phone for an update on the weather is NBC Connecticut meteorologist Ryan Hanrahan. I can't even say the word. I think it's a little too cold out here. Ryan Hanrahan back with us again. Thanks, Ryan, for coming in. I know it's a busy morning.
No problem, John. Thanks for having me.
So the governor says this is a messy storm. It's going to continue for a while. What's the latest? Because we've been tracking this for days. Well, what's exactly happening here in Connecticut?
Well, the heaviest snow is moving in right now. For the viewers, or listeners, I guess I should say, I'm on radio now, down in Fairfield County, you're getting the heaviest snow right now, and that's going to be lifting north. So I think in terms of snow, the worst of this is going to be in the next few hours through midday and early afternoon. And we get a pretty long lull. Then it looks like some more snow moves in later tonight. So it's a very odd storm. It's coming in a few different pieces as opposed to all at one time. But in terms of travel and snow, the worst is going to be right through about 2 or 3 o'clock this afternoon.
And when you say really bad snow coming in right now, the governor was talking about maybe even a path of snow in which we'd have 2, 3, 4 inches an hour. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I mean, I do think we'll probably wind up getting a fairly a big band of 2-inch-per-hour snows at least. That's what we saw down in New York City and parts of Long Island, and that's what's coming. It's coming due north right now, and I'm just looking the visibility at White Plains and Bridgeport's down to a quarter mile. And generally, when you get to about a quarter mile visibility, that's when you're talking about snowfall rates at an inch to two or even more per hour. So it's pretty impressive snow that's coming through. And John, what's sort of interesting about this storm is later tonight, I think we'll get the snow to move north. We'll change things over to an icy mix, which no one wants. Even snow lovers don't like that. And we could have enough instability in the atmosphere. I wouldn't be surprised if we get some thunderstorms right around midnight. So there's a really dynamic storm that's moving in.
Oh, that's pretty scary. So what you're talking about with the ice, though, maybe moving on until later in the day, that's the thing that scares an awful lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Snow we can move, but when we start to think about ice, it not only makes weather conditions very, very treacherous, but it also means potentially power outages. When again do you expect that we might switch over to ice across most of the state?
Well, the switch will happen during the late afternoon, so the precipitation will taper off. It'll come down in intensity, and so we'll see a light wintry mix through the late afternoon into the evening. So we'll probably only be looking at about maybe a tenth to two-tenths of an inch of icing, which isn't enough to take down a tree or a power line. Normally you need about a half inch for that. But what it will do is it will make the snow really heavy, put a little crust on top, and make it tough to move. And that's basically for the I-84 corridor points north. To the south, I think we bring in enough warm air where we'll change things over to plain rain. So New Haven, Norwich, even as far north as Putnam, I think we'll bring in enough warmth that we'll see a transition to just rain in 33 or 34 degrees. So a little bit of everything depending on where you are. And I do think by later on tonight, we will see snow redeveloping, especially in northwestern Connecticut, and we could see an additional 3 to 6 inches of accumulation up in Litchfield County early tomorrow morning before daybreak. So when I was saying that the storm's a little convoluted and a little tricky, that's why, because it's coming in so many different pieces.
A last thing for you, Ryan. This is a really big storm, and it's a storm that's traveling all across the East Coast, it seems. We're getting reports on NPR this morning about terrible icing in the Carolinas and in the Atlanta region. What exactly is behind this storm, and how big is it, really?
Well, I mean, it is huge. At one point yesterday, we had winter storm warnings up from Mississippi all the way to Maine. So you don't see that very often. So the storm is quite large. It's not terribly unusual to get a storm that takes up a large area geographically. What was a little bit unusual is that it had just enough cold air where places that don't typically get a lot of snow or icing, like Atlanta or the Carolinas, were able to get some icing with this storm. But it's the same storm system. It moved out of the southern stream of the jet stream from the desert southwest. It raced across Texas. It picked up moisture from the Gulf of Mexico like they normally do. And so it sort of energizes the storm and it comes right up the coast. And so that's what we're seeing. You can actually track the piece of energy responsible for the storm all the way back to the Pacific Ocean a few days ago. So it's just been racing across the country, and now it's our turn to get the messy weather.
And if you want to keep an eye on this winter storm, of course, Ryan Hanrahan and his colleagues at NBC Connecticut watching it all day and all night long. Ryan, as always, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, John.
Today in the program, we're going to be talking about poverty in America and also poverty right here in Connecticut. Now, 50 years ago, in his State of the Union address, President Lyndon B. Johnson declared a nationwide war on poverty.
Poverty is a national problem, requiring improved national organization and support. But this attack, to be effective, must also be organized at the state and the local level and must be supported and directed by state and local efforts. For the war against poverty will not be won here in Washington. It must be won in the field, in every private home, in every public office, from the courthouse to the White House.
And again, that's President Lyndon B. Johnson declaring war on poverty some 50 years ago. Johnson himself didn't live long enough to see the end of the war on poverty. And as it looks today, most of us might not either. Still 50 million people in poverty in the United States of America. In Connecticut, some 370,000 people. That's just by some recent statistics. We're going to be talking about the statistics today, but we're also going to be talking about the real people affected and what we can do to change this situation that, again, hasn't changed enough in 50 years. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. What are your perspectives on the war on poverty, how it has gone over these many decades? 860-275-7266. In a moment, we'll bring in some people who are working to alleviate the problems of poverty in our state. But first, I want to welcome in Jennifer Klein, who's a professor of history at Yale University, to give us some context on this. Jennifer Klein, welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, tell us about Johnson's war on poverty. What was behind this designation, this use of words at this time back in 1964, in which he decided to declare war on poverty?
Well, I think we partially have to look at it in terms of the circumstances that Johnson came into office in the wake of Kennedy's assassination in Johnson's home state of Texas, and the fact that Johnson was a Southerner and liberals in the Democratic Party were very worried that maybe this person who was now taking over the presidency was going to kind of take the country back to the 50s, and that they weren't really getting a strong Democratic liberal. And so Johnson wanted to really show that he could build upon what Kennedy seemed to have started and also set out a grand agenda for himself of reform. But it's also linked to his background as a New Dealer.
His background as a New Dealer. And tell us more about what he believed that the government could do in this sort of New Deal style to turn around people's fortunes.
Well, first he had been, you know, he came from the Texas Hill Country, and he had been this liaison between farmers in his congressional district and the federal government. And he had been the head of the National Youth Administration and really trying to put people to work through public works. And then once he became a congressman and a senator, he worked tirelessly on farm programs, rural electrification, land conservation. And what's so interesting about it is not only that he was trying to harness, you know, national resources through these federal government programs, but he also really believed that the people closest to them really could control them, and this would be an equitable distribution of natural resources. So when he helped get the Lower Colorado River Authority set up, he had them sell power to farm cooperatives and municipalities. And so, one, what it shows is that he really believed that an activist government could create prosperity. But it also showed that he believed that people should be part of the project, that this was, you know, democratic participation on a local level.
We're talking with Jennifer Klein, a history professor at Yale University, about 50 years of a war on poverty. We'll be talking with some people who are on the ground in a moment trying to solve this problem that has been so intractable over the years. 860-275-7266. One of the, of course, arguments about government intervention in poverty over the years, Jennifer, has been that an activist government can help people, but it creates, in some minds, a system of dependence. If the government is too activist, then those community groups don't form, then individuals don't work in the same way to get themselves or their communities out of poverty. How has that played out over these 50 years?
Well, actually, it was precisely the opposite when we look at the design of the War on Poverty, because while Johnson was very much a son of the New Deal, he went in a slightly different direction in the 1960s. So, for example, they didn't choose to do big public works projects. Instead, at the core of the War on Poverty, with the Office of Economic Opportunity, was something called community action. And this was the notion that federal funds would go directly to poor people themselves in the community, where they would act collectively to decide what were their needs, what had kept them marginalized, and how could they act to change those terms. And so all over the country, at the local level, people actually formed these community action agencies, and poor people began to articulate what were their problems about housing and how could they act on that. How could they form job training programs? How could they deal with problems of lack of access to child care, to medical care? And so that becomes this just remarkable organizing effort throughout the 1960s. And in fact, that's really where it becomes quite successful. And so you see community action agencies that started to run job training programs in Mississippi, in Newark, in Nevada. They ran medical clinics where there had been none for poor people, especially for African Americans. And they also kind of triggered the emergence of a national welfare rights movement. And working together, these people actually empowered themselves to get the services that they weren't otherwise able to get. Now, services on their own are not going to make people not poor, right? It's the lack of income that makes people poor. But the War on Poverty also emphasized education, beginning with Head Start at the preschool level and moving up, and a Job Corps. So it took the notion that, and this is part of the miscalculation of the War on Poverty, but it also assumed that, look, we have a growing economy, and as long as we can stimulate growth in the economy, then what we need to pay attention to is why people are excluded from it. And what does it take to enable people to get into that economy, whether it's better education, job training, or breaking down barriers that have excluded them in various ways. So I think, in fact, what was amazing about the War on Poverty is the way in which it saw poor people as people who should be citizens, who have rights, and we can build up their capacity.
And the idea that we were able to build some people's capacity, make some changes, get people perhaps moving in the right direction, it still leaves us some 50 years later with some 50 million people in poverty in the United States. I mean, how do you think history, Jennifer, treats Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, given the fact that we now end up with a continuing problem that seemingly has not been solved? Fewer people really taking part in the economy that you say, quite rightly, is such an important part of getting out of poverty.
Well, I think there's a couple of things there that we need to think about. Is, first of all, the intervening years. I mean, there was structural change in the economy, and the War on Poverty didn't pay attention to that. And then in the 1970s, we didn't really think about what would actually be an industrial policy that would enable us to pay attention to the shifting economy. The second thing is in some of the places where the War on Poverty was most successful, it also was raising political heat on the established political machinery. So, for example, where volunteers from VISTA went into Appalachia, and they initially went there, you know, to engage in literacy projects and teach poor Appalachian people to read. And then what they started to find out is the community was really suffering from the transition into strip mining, which meant not only loss of jobs in coal mining, but also environmental hazards that were really affecting them in terms of their water and their land quality. And so they started to put a lot of pressure on the state government about the strip mining. And suddenly this became politically dangerous, and they pulled the plug on them. And the same thing happened in Las Vegas, where the women had formed this organization called Operation Life, where they were building all these programs, and they were really raising the political pressure on state and political government well up through the late 1970s. And after Ronald Reagan came in, he pulled the plug on him. And the other important, really important piece of the war on poverty was legal aid or legal services. And what was so important about this was not just that it gave individual poor people legal representation, you know, perhaps they had were not able to get housing or they had been cut off from public assistance benefits, but what it did was it engaged in impact legislation to try to really bring these class action suits that would try to change poverty law in general. And these established through Supreme Court cases new rights for poor people, including rights to public assistance. And so after 1980, conservatives really began to open an assault on legal services and to defund it and to rein in its ability to bring these kind of class action suits in the long run. So I think we have to see that as one dynamic that affected it. But the other is to think about, well, why are people poor today? Well, a lot of that has to do with wage stagnation. You can't live on the minimum wage. The minimum wage actually reached its peak value, in fact, in the late 1960s. So we have wage stagnation, low wages, and we have disempowerment of people to change that. Because the other part of what happened in the 1960s that also contributed to the lowering of the poverty rate was the ability of workers in the lowest wage sectors, in the service sector, and in the public sector to unionize. And so if you think about it, hospital workers who are African American, who were female, who were Puerto Rican, farm workers who were Mexican in California, and sanitation workers, these were part of this new wave of unionization that raised their wages, that won them those rights of employment, and did so by changing the balance of power. And so we now live in an era where wages have not gone up and people don't have those unions anymore. And so I think that contributes a lot to why we're back to a rising poverty rate, because during the years of the war on poverty itself, poverty went down significantly. It was cut in half. It went down from about 22 or 23% to 11%. And then it began to rise again after 1980. So I think we have to be careful not to jump from 1962 to the present. We have to really think about that changing balance of power that began to happen after 1980. And when we do that, then I think we can think about the war on poverty in quite different terms. I don't think it's that the war on poverty lost. I think it's that in many ways it was becoming too successful because it really was enabling poor people to see themselves as people with rights and as people who could act collectively and exert some political power.
We're talking today about President Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty 50 years later. I want to thank Jennifer Klein, a professor of history at Yale University, for her expertise and perspective on this 50-year period. Jennifer, thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you for having me, and I'm really glad we're thinking about this again and bringing that discussion of poverty back into the public realm.
Now, when we come back from our break, we're going to be joined by some who are working to help those in poverty in continuing this fight, something that President Barack Obama continues today.
In a speech 50 years ago, President Johnson talked about communities on the outskirts of hope, where opportunity was hard to come by. Well, today's economic challenges are different, but they've still resulted in communities where, in recent decades, wrenching economic change has made opportunity harder and harder to come by.
You can join the conversation. Have you experienced a life in poverty? What's the best way to help? 860-275-7266 or tweet us at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. 50 years after LBJ declared a war on poverty, still some 50 million Americans living below the poverty level. Today on our conversation on Where We Live, we're going to be talking about this, some of the historical context for it, and what we might do to change this and win this war. 860-275-7266 is the number if you'd like to join us. Joining me in studio right now is Amos Smith, who's president and CEO of the Community Action Agency of New Haven. He's vice chair of CAFCA, that's the Connecticut Association for Community Action, and he's president of the New England Community Action Partnership. Amos, thank you so much for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, John, for having me.
I also want to welcome in by phone James Gatling, who's president and CEO of New Opportunities, Inc., and is also part of the Connecticut Association for Community Action. Dr. Gatling, thank you very much for being here. I appreciate your time.
And thanks for having me.
First of all, Amos Smith, you were listening to that conversation about the historical context with our historian from Yale University, and she's making the case that 50 years ago, LBJ's war on poverty got us moving in the right direction. The intervening years have not allowed, in her mind, enough people to take part in our economy. When you hear the raw numbers, Amos, and you hear of all these people still in Connecticut in poverty and across the nation, why do you think that this persists 50 years on?
I think Dr. Klein actually hit the nail on the head when she said that systemic change occurred. America was a great society, and it still is, except that it just decided to not want to treat its poor people better. And when changes occurred in legislation, it muted the opportunity for poor people to raise themselves up. And I don't mean raise themselves up by their own bootstraps, but with help from each other. And so government started out with an effort to help and then decided to create a surge to mute the influences of what could happen when poor people actually started working to improve the quality of their own lives.
When we talk about poor people in America, one of the things I want to make sure I get to, and I think this is vital, we have these poverty numbers, the family of four that is supposed to subsist on something around $23,000, $24,000 a year. The idea, frankly, sir, is almost ludicrous that that's what we call poor. So in your mind, when we talk about poverty, Amos, what are we really talking about here? Because a number that low, that's not poverty. That's so far below what we can live on in America that it's almost amazing. What's real poverty to you?
It's a person who is born in America, in particular in Connecticut, and whose chances, because of economic circumstances, more likely places them in a line to go to prison more so than it does for them to go to college. We pay for that child's education up through high school, but refuse to pay for college to the community college level, which some states are beginning to see as a connection. We are bleeding because we don't have the ability to pay people, at least we've chosen not to pay people a livable wage or a meaningful wage and work. And so much of our activity is focused on helping young children. The reality is that if you want to help young children, you help the adults of those children. So the problem, as we see it, ends up being that poverty comes when people are working and can't afford to buy food that allow them to last for a full month. And for instance, we were spending somewhere around $10,000 a year for food stuff to hand out when I first started in New Haven. We spend well over $40,000, and that's buying food at a much more nominal rate than we spend, and we still run out of our food pantry two and three times a year. Mm-hmm. And that's with aggregated. So families don't eat well, they don't work, they have difficulty finding housing. A couple of years ago, during the big recession, the homeless rate in New Haven went up 800%. Mm-hmm. And so people lost houses, people are sort of bunking together, families are being split apart. Poor people have a very little resource to move around in terms of transportation, access to work, and very few work training programs that actually become involved in are unable to move them from that training program into a job that lasts and pays a livable wage.
James Gatling, you've been listening to Amos Smith's definition of what real poverty is here in Connecticut. Expand on this for us. What else do we need to think about and talk about when we talk about who's really living in poverty in Connecticut today?
Well, you know, I go back to I like to go back to the context of what happened in 1964 versus what's going on today. When Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the Economic Opportunity Act, We must remember that that was during the time, the same time that the Civil Rights Act was signed. So there was a major wind of change going on in this country. And basically what Lyndon Baines Johnson stated that everybody has the right to education, housing, food, and that type of thing. But it wasn't going to be a dole out, but they was going to create the opportunities. And through education and job training, people would get that. Ms. Klein indicated, the war on poverty was very successful. It was, in fact, it was too successful. That's why there has been major retreats in terms of the government wanting to assist in these programs. Like, for example, in the city of Waterbury, we used to have summer youth employment program for the kids to keep them out of trouble. So also, so they could earn money, so they could buy clothes to go back to school and that type of thing. And what happened was those programs were stripped. Back in 1970, we had at least 4,000 kids participating in that program. Fast forward into 2014, we only have opportunities for 100 kids to participate in the summer youth employment program. In the meantime, the young people in Waterbury are going to jail by the hundreds. And so the retreat that has taken place as a result of the program being so successful, because when we first started the movement, it was a whole community effort. We had more college graduates, kids getting educated, and college graduates coming out because they participated in the programs that were created. When the movement started, it was like a whole community effort. And as Johnson said in his speech, everybody had to participate in solving the problem. And so back then, it was a whole community effort. Everybody was concerned about their neighbor. Everybody was concerned about how do we get to the next level. And because that was going so well, and plus many minorities learn how to be strong advocates, and we fought for a lot of programming. And then when Nixon became president, he tried to shut the whole movement down. And we took him to court, and we won. But as a result of all of this, each year the funding continued to erode and erode, and so that the program started becoming ineffective, so to speak, in that we couldn't do a lot of the things that we did to make us successful.
Well, and I want to tell our listeners that we're talking with James Gatling and Amos Smith. They're both involved in the Connecticut Association for Community Action. James Gatling from New Opportunities, Inc., Amos Smith from the Community Action Agency of New Haven. And we're talking about this war on poverty declared by Lyndon Johnson some 50 years ago this year, a war on poverty that our guests are saying was being won, but there have been a number of rollbacks in the intervening years. We'd like to hear your thoughts about this, whether it's about the history over the course of these last 50 years, or whether you have a thought about how to solve a problem of poverty today. 860-275-7266 is the phone number. Again, 860-275-7266. Amos Smith, this is one of the quandaries, though, that both you and James Gatling have been talking about, also a professor from Yale. It seems as though there's been a political fight over poverty as much as anything else. The problem is that some might look at the way the United States expends resources to help those in poverty or those just above the poverty line and say, well, we're spending a lot of money right now, but we're not getting the results that we need. So from your perspective, and maybe we can talk about state resources as well here in Connecticut, what are the things, Amos, we need to do to spend money smarter that we do have, that we do expend, in order to help people in their situation today?
That's a fascinating question. I think that we certainly need to understand that work matters, irrespective of of whether you're black or white. We also have to understand that place matters, that we have to do something about the places where people live. And so I think that in the state of Connecticut, we've begun to invest in supportive housing. But if you don't change the culture in those communities, it doesn't really change the organism in terms of the way that families actually function. You can put people in a new house, not change the culture, and that house will become old real quick, real soon.
And talk about, what do you mean by the culture? What are the specific problems in the culture?
That is that the difference between 1964 and 2014 is that when I grew up in public housing, I grew up around people that went to work every day. See, it's hard for children to grow up and not see role models for what they want to become and also have a vibrant community. The other thing that happened for me was that I grew up in the segregated South. So while there was legal discrimination or de facto discrimination by that time of this law, there was a coming together of the community. So right now we have kids growing up in the inner city where it's dangerous to know who your neighbor is, because we've allowed gangs to flourish and to mute the real vibrancy of neighborhoods. So this isn't just a social service problem. It just isn't a poverty problem. There's also a control. It's a matter of figuring out how do we manage community in a vibrant sense. I think New Haven is a world-class community, not just because Yale is in it, but because it has the potential to be a satellite and a guiding light for almost any new project or program that will flourish in America. I think Head Start actually started in New Haven. So part of the problem is that this isn't just an economic issue. It's also an issue of public will. And I'll just say this last thing.
Yes.
Poverty, the discussion about how we treat our own people, didn't even arise in the last two national elections. Was not a part of that conversation. I wonder why. We had 40 or 50 million people in poverty then. Why did we collude in missing that as an opportunity to have a conversation about how do we treat the least well among us?
People in poverty don't vote as much.
Well, there is a, you could say that that's a fact, or you could say it's a myth. So you also have people blocking the opportunities for people in poverty to vote, because people are aware that they can get away with it. You can frighten and you can scare poor people because they are less resourceful. They don't have the understanding and sophistication about what their rights really are.
And there have been some amazing studies recently on resiliency, the idea that the more you have to struggle in your life to feed yourself, to feed your kids, to get to work if you have a job or find a job for the first time, the more of that you have to do, the less likely you are to be able to engage in your community, the less likely you are to be able to be resilient when something bad happens.
There are circles of influence and circles of control. As professionals, we say to people, pick your fight. So if I have to spend most of my day trying to figure out how to get food for my children, and I have to ride three or four buses to do that, I might not have the energy to go and vote for somebody if I don't believe the system's going to change. So one of the things that my parents had that I've seen a lot of our clients not have, is my parents had hope that the world would change for me. And it did. I was the last of six children born, but I was the first to go to college. They hoped that all of my siblings would at least finish high school, when in fact the norm in the South was that black kids didn't finish high school. And only the middle class and the upper middle class blacks went to college. So the point is that I think that there are ways to think about how we treat people who have been less fortunate, not because of their own lack of industry, but because there is an organized and systemic effort to not have people play and to live into stereotypes.
We're going to take some calls at 860-275-7266, including this one from Manny, who's calling from Hamden. Hi, Manny. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yeah, hi. One component of this, there are many, But something that I see is that the lack of an industrial policy for our country. The jobs are not out there that are good paying, that are based upon trade, based upon even union-based jobs. Unions have been relentlessly attacked over the past 30, 40 years. And the industrial policy thing is a real big problem, because those jobs were very high paying, and they were it was when our country was really exporting our manufacturing skills and technology to other places. And what the decision was made, especially around the time of NAFTA, was, and even before then, is we're going to ship those jobs somewhere else, because we want to diminish the power of unions. We want to lower people's wages because it benefits the corporations and the wealthy.
Manny, what I want to do, and thank you very much for that. It raises a good question I want to put to James Gatling before we have to take a break. What Manny's talking about there is again another of these, in his mind, systemic changes to really force down the amount that the American worker can make in jobs like manufacturing to change the constitution of our workforce. I think one issue a lot of people might have with that, James Gatling, is that, the economy has changed. The things we need to make have changed an awful lot. Is this, as Manny says, about the quality of the jobs that America has right now?
Well, I think that's true, but I also think that when we have this discussion about poverty, we forget that technology, as well as globalization, has gotten rid of a lot of jobs that we used to have. And so because of that, poverty, the people that you would have a stereotype of in poverty are no longer that. People in poverty now is everybody, you, me, and our neighbors. And it's not the same thing. And I just think that when and if this country gets through this, and I know we will, that people are going to be looking at people in poverty totally different than they did in the past, because everyone thinks that because of the high unemployment rate, people don't really want to work. People want to work, but they haven't been able to find jobs for a living wage, because the jobs don't exist. And like they said, there's a lot of high-tech jobs that exist, but that's not like it used to be for a lot of people. It's just for a few people. It's just a few high-tech jobs may be available. So this whole notion that people are lazy and don't want to work, I think that's a false notion. And I think because of the economy has changed, many of the jobs that used to be here are no longer here, and it's putting everybody in a real quandary at this point. But that has nothing to do with the war on poverty, the original intent, and where we are today. And the 50,000 people that's in poverty, the 50 million people that are in poverty in this country, is a reflection on a lot of the policies that were made. And I agree with the caller on that.
May I just say
quickly, Amos? Yeah,
I want to add to that in this particular point. There have been job losses abroad, but there's been another change, and that is that the people at the top have been greedy. Proportionally, when you look at the amount of money that they take on by comparison during the period when we were really working as a great society, it's in the stratosphere. And you take the top earners. They don't produce a thing. People on Wall Street don't produce a tangible item. They manipulate numbers. They take on exorbitant salaries. And if the distribution in terms of wage stratification was similar to where it was in the 50s or 60s, you'd probably be able to put people more to work. You might not even have to offshore manufacturing in the way that you did. And that's happened not just in financial services. It's happened in healthcare. There's been a shift in healthcare where healthcare executives have actually gotten stratospheric raises for doing what? More than they were doing before. So I think that we have to understand this, not just the contextual thing to distort us and have us look at the fact that there have been offshoring. There's also been greediness inside of this country, and where the more they make, the fewer people they employ.
We're talking with Amos Smith and also James Gatling. They both represent the Connecticut Association for Community Action. Amos Smith from the Community Action Agency of New Haven, James Gatling from New Opportunities, Inc. When we come back, we're going to be talking more about the educational component of all this. We're going to be taking more of your phone calls as we look back at 50 years of the war on poverty here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, you may think of oysters as just a luxury item, something that you get to eat periodically, but they've been one of Connecticut's biggest economic drivers for years. There's a new exhibit at the Bruce Museum called Oysters, Pearls of Long Island Sound. We're going to be tracing some of the economic history of these bizarre mollusks. We're going to find out a little bit more about why people started eating such a strange food so many years ago. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. Today on the program, we're talking about 50 years of the war on poverty. LBJ declared war some 50 years ago. But are we any closer toward ending poverty? Still some 50 million people in poverty in the United States. We're talking with some people who are on the ground right now trying to deal with this issue. I also want to bring in David Morgan, who's vice president of Team Inc. and president of the Connecticut Head Start Association, to talk about one other aspect of this. We're going to get to some more of your phone calls in a moment at 860-275-7266. But first, David Morgan, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We've talked about a lot of the inequities and some of the gaps that we have here between the rich or maybe even the middle class and the poor today. Education, of course, a big piece of this. What role do you think education or the lack of education for certain segments of our society has played in this continuing problem with poverty in America?
Well, it's already been well established and well stated just in the past hour. There's no more important strategy for improving social and economic mobility than education and training. And when you look at President Johnson's war on poverty, Head Start was born right out of that whole initiative. Sergeant Shriver, the director of the Office of Economic Opportunity, actually got a national panel to look into to get zeroed down into early childhood. It was an awful situation of how many children nationwide were in poverty. And so a couple months later, birthed the Head Start initiative that established in 1965. And really its charge was to promote the school readiness for children in low-income families by offering them educational services, nutritional services, health and well-being services, social services, other family support services, and mental health referral services. And it has been so successful as each decade has gone on, even after so much scrutiny, that it also expanded into early Head Start. And you know, so when it was originally envisioned, it looked at low-income young children ages 3 to 5 to get into a preschool experience so they can actually turn the corner and be ready for success in the primary school. And all the research has really demonstrated that a child who's gone through a Head Start experience is meeting the national norms of peers who were not experiencing poverty.
And of course, now we hear this week from Governor Malloy that he wants to expand more pre-kindergarten programs to more kids across the state. It's something that really we understand through all the research does help people. One of the things we've looked at here on the show, David, is the number of kids who are actually getting their only warm meals at school, breakfast, lunch, sometimes dinner. The local school is the place where they are getting their needs met.
You're absolutely right. And I think that really hit true. Something I heard throughout this last hour that I think is really important is that there's not enough full engagement and discussion about the experiences of poverty. The society at large tends to either just leave it out on the periphery, think it's acceptable, or don't think it's a challenge, or it's not really much of an issue. And so I think it really hit home when you looked at the federal sequester and the very next day and how that shut down some Head Starts right here in Connecticut and nationwide. One of those stories touched on what you just said is now these families had little to no access to a nutritional meal 3 times a day. Again, we're looking at the federal poverty level guideline for Head Start children. So that is, you imagine about 63% of the Head Start families in Connecticut, they're single-parent households. Mm-hmm. So you imagine a mother of one, she's making less than $16,000 a year right here in Connecticut. That's 90% of the Head Start population that we're serving here in Connecticut. And you imagine the challenges and the choices or the lack of choices that they have. They don't choose that path. it's a lot of the economic barriers and disadvantages where their path is already set, as we heard earlier.
Well, I want to get to a few phone calls. Cynthia's in Stanford. Hi, Cynthia. Go ahead.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. What's up?
Thank you for this marvelous program on this stormy morning. I can't really question. I just want to say that we need to take this conversation statewide. I happen to be affiliated with a community action program that is very much in distress, and I think the agency is being blamed without looking at the historical and systemic implications. And so when we talk about poverty today, it is much more than I ever faced as a child. I call myself one of the Lyndon Baines Johnson children, but my parents were able to provide for us, and so many parents are not able to provide. I don't want to recount everything that's been said this morning, but I want to encourage this conversation to be held throughout the state so that appropriate partnerships can be reinforced, enlarged, to really begin to effectively, systemically address the natures of poverty in the state of Connecticut. We have to look at where we are educationally on a national level.
Yeah.
That talks about why we're having difficulty in the training and our children getting employed. We have to teach our children to be entrepreneurs. There's a lot of work that can be done, and we have the talent in the state to do that.
And Cynthia, thank you for that, and I don't think any of us could have said it any better. I want to quickly go to Pete on a cell phone. Pete, go ahead. We just have a few moments left here.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, this problem goes back probably to the beginning of humankind. There's always going to be people at the top, and there's always going to be people at the bottom, and bridging that gap is the trick. Here's the thing. It's gotten to a point where the people at the top now have manipulated the system so well and created laws and all these rules and regulations that actually for the poor to do something about it is a challenge. And people don't really care when it becomes tough. They give up, and, you know, they go back to their Jerry Springer, and they go back to eating, you know, horrible foods, which does have an effect on your attitude. I mean, this is a – what you're asking to do is a huge life change, and that is a major problem. I think we have to start – with replacing the people that at the top with.
Well, and I'll just get a quick comment here from Amos, because we just have about a minute left, and I'd love to hear you respond.
So John, what's interesting is that if you think about the notion that poor people don't vote, if you work at a community action agency, the Congress passed a law in 1997 to prohibit community action agencies from enrolling people to vote, just registering people to vote, which blocks them. Now, if you work for Head Start, you could actually enroll them through Head Start, but not community action. You think about what Dr. Klein said, what Dr. Gatlin said. They said that there's been a historic change. That's one of the changes that have muted the impact of community action. We serve 13,000 people over 18 in New Haven. Dr. Gatlin serves somewhere around 25,000. If we were actually able to do the kind of things that we did, we would inspire people to take action on their own behalf. But somehow we have to work around all the politics and legislation that have been designed to mute the influence of low-income people.
And as we heard from our caller, Cynthia, I think it's important for us and the rest of the state to continue this conversation. And I very much appreciate you coming in and talking with us a bit about it on this, as we say, stormy day. Amos Smith, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Amos Smith is president and CEO of the Community Action Agency of New Haven, and he's vice chair of CAFCATS, the Connecticut Association for Community Action. He joined us in studio today. I also want to thank our guests by phone, James Gatling, who is the president and CEO of New Opportunities, Inc., and also David Morgan, vice president of Team, Inc., and president of the Connecticut Head Start Association. We have started a conversation here today that we'd like to continue online at WNPR.org. Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan today. This is Where We Live.